It's just the determination of your livelihood.
What project?
Remember we did the... We talked about MAID? Medical assistance in dying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And what did I say? You just wanted to talk about death and dying, right?
Basically, yeah. Okay. And how it related to those laws that they're passing in Canada.
All right, I got Gavin here. Gavin is my... Oh, wait.
I'll do the introduction, all right?
All right. I'm the new one. Okay, let's start over here. Who cares? Go ahead.
Okay. My name's Gavin. I am Michael's nephew. He raised me for a long time as a kid. He's my uncle. He's great. And we are talking theology. I have really nothing interesting to add on a lot of these subjects, but I do have a lot of questions. You know, I go to college at the University of Oklahoma, and I'm exposed to a lot of the ideas there, especially around theology and everything. I'm you know, somewhat involved in the...
You know, your mom was the first one who, whenever she was at OU, that was 1994, I think it was, she was at OU, and a kind of postmodernism and liberalism had just started. There was nothing before that, hardly. I mean, there was some somewhere, you know, some universities. But your mom went to OU, and she came home and she said she took a class on Sir Conan Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, yeah. And they told her to go home and tell what the passage meant to her. And it was kind of like...
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that story many times. I know it's... I don't know. It's just, it's odd, really. Everything is. And it's...
At my place, we had a little bit like that. Well, I went to OU, too, for a little while, but UCO. But that's when it started. 1990s was the beginning of postmodernism.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I honestly don't think it's... I like classes like that, I do, because it really is up to you for the most part, you know? You decide how you interpret it, unless they're being super stringent on the grading. Like, somewhere with my mom, apparently, with the Sir Conan Doyle.
No, you get in trouble if you interpret it the right way. You do.
Maybe, but I don't know. I don't think it's as bad as people say.
Oh, it's bad. It's bad. I don't know. Well, that's what we're going to have to talk about.
I guess.
Okay, well, then we're going to do conversations with Gavin. I don't know. It's a conversation with Gavin. I'm going to do a conversation with Gavin. Gavin wanted to call this basement theology. It doesn't matter. This is the first one. And I just wanted to talk to... I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, Gavin, just about theology. And, you know, of course, like you said, you grew up here. Mm-hmm. You grew up with us. And so it's not as if this is your first time coming into contact with theology, but now that you're in college and stuff, and you've been calling, asking lots of really good questions,
yeah,
especially about dispensationalism. So I thought that would be a fun one to talk about. Dispensationalism.
Yeah, that's
because I've done a couple of things. I've been forced to talk about dispensationalism, which
It's a scary topic.
It's not scary. It's just, I don't like it. I really don't. I used to love it.
Well, people have very strong opinions about it.
Well, tell me about what's going on.
Okay, well, me personally...
I didn't teach you the word dispensationalism, did I?
No.
Okay, so... Purely you.
I don't really know... I don't have myself a big opinion on the topic, right? It's just... It's odd that it's just all of a sudden, everything, all at once about dispensationalism. You know, everybody's talking about it everywhere. Church, you go to church, they're talking about it. It's just odd, because I've never been exposed to it before. You know, it's never been a big deal. Our relationship with Israel has never been a big deal. And, you know, that's where it really starts. So let's work backwards. Let's start with now, the modern state, where we're at with Israel, and go backwards to the beginning of dispensationalism in the 1800s.
I don't think that's what you can do. I mean, because the beginning of dispensationalism, yes, as a movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, all movements have their beginning somewhere, like Calvinism and that. 1600s, but it has its roots, you could say, all the way back to Paul, all the way back to Augustine, you know?
Well, sure.
And so it's like the history of the movement is good, but it's really the components that make the movement that matter, because you can get caught up in this idea of kind of this genetic fallacy or kind of the C.S. Lewis type historical snobbery, mm-hmm. you know, that... Oh, you guys are just being snobs, mm-hmm. because you've come up with something new and nobody else knew about it beforehand. Mm-hmm. And that's not really what the way that I like to start it. I mean, we can if you want to go back.
Well, here, why don't you define dispensationalism as you see it, and then if there is a difference with how people use it now,
describe that. No, no. I want you to define dispensationalism as they're telling you, as what you've heard about it.
I don't know. Dispensationalism, to me, is the separation of the people of God being Christians and the people of God being the ethnic Jews.
Okay.
That's the basis for dispensationalism that I've heard. Okay. Well,
I mean,
expound.
Okay. Well, you're right about the importance of the separation between the two as far as concept of dispensationalism, but not as far as the purpose of dispensationalism or what's called the telos of dispensationalism. The end, what is it going towards?
Mm-hmm.
What is its end game? You could say, well, yeah, I mean, there's a separation between the Old and the New Testaments, right?
Mm-hmm.
And between the Old and the New Testament, you got Jewish Israel under the law and you have Christians in the New Testament under the church. Those are two different dispensations,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. And so dispensationalism for a long time, when I first learned about it, it was about breaking the Bible up into those segments, you mm-hmm. know? And everybody does. Everybody breaks it up into segments. So you can't get away from that.
Yeah.
But it's that's what's called the dispensations. A dispensation is a way of economy. It's an administration.
So why do people say that it came up with in the 1800s or that it originated then?
Well, dispensationalism as a movement, as a organized movement, came up at that time.
Okay, so what is the movement of dispensationalism?
Well, okay, let me tell you how it started. It started with the Plymouth Brethren. I'm not really good on the exact beginnings of dispensationalism.
I've read that.
Okay, with the Plymouth Brethren, a guy named J.N.D. Darby. Actually, it has a lot to do with my seminary, too, Dallas Theological Seminary. If you asked anybody that's in the know right now, where is the bastion of dispensationalism, it would be Dallas Seminary. Even everybody at Dallas Seminary was so sick of talking about it, I don't think they've really talked much about it since the 90s or the early 90s. A guy named Charles Ryrie left Dallas Seminary in 1980, and it hasn't. I out of all the classes I took, 128 hours, 132, I don't remember,
mm-hmm.
but not one class on dispensationalism. I had to read one book, Progressive Dispensationalism, but we never even discussed it. So anyway, I say all that for people whenever they're watching this, because they always think, oh, he went to Dallas Seminary, so obviously he's a born and bred dispensationalist. Not really,
mm-hmm.
because they don't really teach it. And they may now, but I doubt they're teaching it more since 2002 to today, because it's just kind of... Eschatology is the doctrine of the end times, mm-hmm. right? And with the doctrine of the end times, you have... let's go back. It really has more... Dispensationalism, more than anything else, started with a kind of a Bible study movement.
Mm-hmm.
It started in response to liberalism. It kind of like, and I know this is not going to sound very good, but it came at the same time as the Christadelphians, the Mormons, the Jehovah's Witnesses, all the cults.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, Seventh-day Adventist, Bible study movement, the Bible church movement. It was basically at a time where liberalism had taken hold of the church and said, yeah, we can't really take the Bible that seriously anymore. You know, here's all the problems, here's all the contradictions, here's, you know, putting it together mm-hmm. and really putting it under a critical eye. That the church, it's not that the church hadn't done that. You can read people mm-hmm. in church history going through and doing that stuff. But at that time, it was more of a critical eye that was accepted by culture. So all of the Western culture was like, you're nobody unless you're kind of into liberal theology,
mm-hmm.
German liberalism.
And you're talking about Christian liberalism, not like just liberalism in general, right? Not the liberal movement. It's theological liberalism.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, they're very related.
But yeah, but...
You're right to separate the two. So you have... Nobody taking the Bible seriously, and a lot of people, and really in the church, the people who did take the Bible seriously, it was more like you had either the hardcore scholastics who were reformers or from the Reformation, but they were acting like the Catholics that we left. In other words, they are saying, we believe what we believe because here's what John Calvin said. Here's what, you know, going through church mm-hmm. history and really giving what it's called a gloss. Here's what we believe based upon what everybody else believed before us, rather than starting fresh all the time, which mm-hmm. is really what you should do. You should start afresh and not neglect history. Mm-hmm. But you can't start with history and then go to the Bible, because you're going to be predisposed towards whatever you've been taught. And so the Reformation was really good about that, starting us over and saying, Catholic Church, love you. You know, institutionalized Catholic Church, you've done a lot of good, but at the same time, the bad is outweighing the good.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the time when, during liberalism, that we said, all right, we're not listening to liberals. We believe the Bible, but let's interpret the Bible from the standpoint of where the Bible starts. You know, and that's where it came from. Now, having said that, the most important element, this is really important, the most important element of dispensationalism is to start with what's called a authorial intent hermeneutic. And people don't really realize how important this is and how much it drives dispensationalism. How much it drove Dallas Seminary. Whenever I went to Dallas Seminary, now I did learn that very, very much. It's sometimes called historico-grammatico hermeneutics, or historical, grammatical, literary hermeneutics, and it's basically saying this: whenever you start with the Bible, whatever you're going to in the Bible, whether Old Testament, New Testament, whatever genre, whether it's the Psalms or whether it's Paul, you got to approach it by its own rules. So you can't come and say, here's what I'm seeing whenever I look at this. Like somebody sat around in a group and said, read this Bible verse, and they read the Bible verse, and everybody goes around in the group and says, what does it mean to you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's subjectivism. That is saying it gains its power, it gains its authority. You hear from God only whenever you listen inside and try to figure out what the Bible means to you in your current circumstance. Mm-hmm. People are going to come up with all kinds of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this was kind of the options you had at the time. And dispensationalism said, no, we're going to take the Bible seriously. I'm not saying other people don't. Okay, because covenant theologians and others, they really do. I mean, there's incredible people who are not dispensationalists. A lot smarter than I am, for sure, right?
Mm-hmm.
But whenever you start with the dispensationalists, you have to say, we are opening the Bible, and whatever, here's the key, this is really key, whatever the original author meant to say, and whatever they hear or heard, if it was heard correctly, that's what we want to know before anything else. I don't care. It's even before Christ, okay? Because we're not even going to read Christ into it. And that's a big deal, because you might say, whoa, you're going to do it before Christ? Why not? We're not going to say we're reading the Old Testament and finding Christ, finding the real meaning of, say, the Ark of the Covenant or the Noah's Ark.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to look at that and say, that is Christ. And mm-hmm. that's what it meant to do. Christ is our Ark. Beautiful, and it's true.
But it's not what it meant to the authors, right?
It's not what it was about. You got to figure out what it meant in that day. And that's the key, because whenever dispensationalists go back to the Old Testament, they look at certain promises, Genesis chapter 12, Genesis chapter 15, 17, 21, all of those reiterated, I mean, many other times too, from many of the other patriarchs. But whenever you go back to that, you see, what did Abraham hear whenever he got this promise, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the basic principle is this: whatever Abraham heard, whatever God meant whenever he said it to Abraham at that time, in that circumstance, in that culture, in that day, in that language, everything. That's why dispensational, that's why I had to take so much in the original languages. Mm-hmm. I mean, we really do. It's like you got to get to the understanding of exactly what that meant, even if it's to the sacrifice of beautiful things like Christ being the Ark, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the church sometimes does that. I don't mind it.
Well, but those don't have to be mutually exclusive, right? I mean, you can.
Yeah, they do.
Why?
They have to be mutually exclusive
at
the starting point.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's the key. You can overlay for sure, mm-hmm. and you have to.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be able to find all kinds of things after you get the right meaning. And then based upon that right meaning, now what can you do? You know, how can you see, like, you whenever you get to the New Testament, you point to the Old Testament with a flashlight, kind of. It lights up more, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, oh, now I understand this stuff. Now I get what they were trying to say in this prophecy. But it's not as if that flashlight is determinative. It just makes it brighter, makes it more, you understand it more. It doesn't give it its real meaning necessarily. You can't really start with that, because then you'll lower the literal meaning. You'll lower mm-hmm. the real meaning. You'll lower the what it meant and to the author.
And that's more theologically liberal if you were to do that, right?
You know what? Now listen to this. This is funny. Good thing you said that. Dan Wallace, you know, one of my professors and somebody I respect very much. One time he said, we have learned, because liberals, yeah, people are going to take this wrong. Liberals taught us how to interpret the Bible a whole lot
mm-hmm.
because we had become so spiritualized, so many layers of meaning in the Bible. Like in the early church, you had three layers of meaning. You had the, oh gosh, I'm not going to remember them, but you had the literal, which was important, you know. Everybody said it was important. It's not as if I'm going to say they all lowered it, but it wasn't the most important, because the most important was the moral and the spiritual. And so if you could find those, if you could mine out the Bible and kind of be in prayer, think really hard, and you'll be able to see something more. You'll see something deeper, what the Bible really means in this passage. And then you'll wow people whenever you're giving a sermon, because you'll be giving a sermon and they'll be like, how in the world does he see all this in that passage? And many times it's beautiful. It really is. But at the same time, it's not there. It's just not there, no matter how beautiful it is. And so whenever dispensationalism is first about a hermeneutic, which means a method of interpretation, a hermeneutic that says you've got to, at all costs, understand what the original author meant first before anything else, and you can't move on before you learn that. So now let me show you something, okay?
Okay.
Now you have the Abrahamic promise. You can't make an argument from the text whenever you're reading up to Genesis chapter 12.
That's that not literal.
He should have known something more was coming at that mm-hmm. point. Or he knew deep down inside this is Christ. And many people do that are non-dispensationalists. I'm not saying everybody does. I'm not jumping on people. But I see people saying Abraham truly believed in the second person of the Trinity coming and dying for their sins and raising from the grave, because that's what that passage means, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The Abrahamic promise is to the church, and it's about Christ creating a church. I'm like, Abraham didn't know that. Abraham had no clue about that. Let me give you one real good illustration. Really good illustration, okay? Okay, Genesis chapter 3:15. It's called the Proto-Evangelion.
Mm-hmm.
The first gospel. Proto-Evangelion. I like that word. That's a good one. Leave here with that word.
Okay, we'll do.
Proto-Evangelion. Well, it's the first gospel because it's the first time in the Bible that you hear the gospel being presented. And in Genesis chapter 3:15, it's after Adam and Eve had sinned, and God is cursing the snake and, you know, giving the punishment to Adam and Eve. And he's talking to the snake, and he says, the seed of the woman will crush your head, but you will bruise his heel.
Yeah.
And he gives that, okay, whenever you're reading that, it is a comfort passage to Adam and Eve, because he's saying what this guy, this spiritual evil entity did, I'm going to fix. Mm-hmm. That's all they knew. Because whenever they're reading, just think of yourself hearing that in the Garden of Eden, you're thinking, okay, the seed of a woman, okay, I think that's maybe one of my children, my mm-hmm. progeny. She could have understood that probably. It was one of my progeny. Will crush the head of the serpent. What did that mean to her at that time? That's the question mm-hmm. you ask. And you say, what?
Well, to me, if I were told that...
After what you just did
mm-hmm.
in the garden.
It means that, I mean, I will be sanctified eventually through my seed, who will defeat the evil that I gave into.
God's going to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you, the stuff you screwed up on, God's going to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not. There's going to be somebody else coming mm-hmm. from you, right? So that's exactly right. And so that's all you've got. You can't say at that point, she understood that it was the second person of the Trinity who was uh-huh. going to die on a cross and raise 3 days later. After he was raised, stay on the earth for 40 days and then create a church, right?
Mm-hmm.
All she knew in this gospel was what we broke, God's going to fix. I don't know what that means. That guy's going to be messed up. his evil will be done away with. And I don't know what more it means or what. All I know is it has to mean at least that. That's the key. It has to mean at least that. It can mean more, but it can't mean less. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So whatever God intended to communicate can always mean more. But it's not as if he's going to lie to you in order to make it mean more. So like, pull an end around, right? So I'm going to promise you this, but it's not really what you thought it was. It's something completely different. But I gave you the implications that that's what it was, right? And I knew you were going to think that. And I knew that if you interpreted it the best you could, that's all you could get. But you're wrong. It's over here. But it's better. It's even more, mm-hmm. right? So anyway, the basic principle is this. Whatever it meant in its original context, to its original hearers, by the original author, it can mean more. It can't mean less.
So if you're going to the Abraham promise, would it not mean more to have a church that goes around the world? You know what I mean? It incorporates way more people than just one ethnicity. It's everybody who can appreciate, you know, God and Christ and the church. So how is that not more than what was promised?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, that's what dispensationalists believe. You see, here now we got to get to the history of dispensationalism, because anybody who critiques dispensationalism is critiquing a very first inception of it, right?
Mm-hmm. So real quick, we're talking about the dispensationalist movement now, and not just the theology or the idea
of the dispensation. I don't know right? how I would define a movement. I mean, I don't really know what that means.
Like the separation of the movement and the idea? Because earlier you said the dispensations, that's been an idea since the beginning of the church almost, right? But the real movement started in the 1800s. So what was the difference that made it?
Well, the movement came about because of liberalism. It came out of the rise of liberalism and taking the Bible seriously and starting fresh.
So it was just going back to the previous ideas is what you're saying.
I would say that here's the deal. Okay, here's another thing that's really, really important for you to understand, because people critique dispensationalism based upon this. They'll act as if there's some type of trump card by saying it came about in the 18th century, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Which I...
People do that with everything, though. It's not just dispensationalism. Any idea that has arrived, came about after the first couple centuries,
it's like that. And it's, again, back to C.S. Lewis, the historical snobbery. Mm-hmm. We got it right now. Nobody else had it right before. That's not what's being said here. Whenever you're talking about the development of theology, let me give you an example. You know how we believe that Christ died for our sins because God required it. Mm-hmm. It's God's wrath that was placed upon Christ while he was on the cross, right? Mm-hmm. Do you know when that came about? That's called the substitutionary atonement theory. You know when that came about?
Mm-mm.
10th century.
Wow.
Nobody believed that until then. It's not that they disbelieved it.
It just hadn't been developed. Yeah.
There's questions that get asked throughout history. Like, you know, the Trinity. What Trinity? Mm-hmm. When did it come about? About the 3rd century. When did it get established? The early 4th century. And how did we come to know that? It's not as if people didn't believe it beforehand. They didn't know how Jesus was God and the Father is God and the Holy Spirit mm-hmm. is God, yet they're not each other. We don't know it much better now.
Yeah, we just assigned a word for it.
Yeah. We got a word, but we had to go through and say, we don't know what the Trinity is exactly, but we know what it's not. And it's not modalism. It's not that Jesus, God, is one God and he shows himself in 3 different ways. We had to have heresies come from every angle.
Before you could actually get the definition. Yeah, because you had to get out of polytheism, out of modalism.
And what do we do? What's the first thing we do in church history? The first thing we do is develop who is Christ. And then what is the Trinity? And then what is man in the 5th century? Did you know that I've taught you, and you probably heard in our traditions quite a bit, you won't hear this in Eastern Orthodoxy quite as much because they don't hold this quite as much. But we hold to that we were connected to Adam, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was reading last night, because we do the Through the Church Fathers in a year, right? How was that?
Quick plug. Yeah, very good.
And I was looking at our face family tree, right?
Yeah.
And I was reading, not any of them. I was reading Shepherd of Hermes, which is, that was in one canon of the Bible that we found. You know, I mean, it's not as if it almost made it, right? Mm-hmm. But it was very respected in the early church. Very, very well respected. As a matter of fact, whenever you go through the Apostolic Fathers right there, the Apostolic Fathers are basically the earliest church fathers that were connected to the apostles. And whenever you read through that, Shepherd of Hermes will be there. It's in that, right? Because it's that well respected. But I was reading it last night, and it basically starts with the idea that we are all neutral, just like Adam.
Mm.
You don't have any, you have your own chance in the same way Adam did, which I don't, I mean.
I mean, we, but that's, you, that's not what we believe now. That's
no,
not
no,
what
no,
anybody,
it's not. No, no.
Yeah.
No, not even Eastern Orthodox. They believe, yeah. Yes, you kind of, but you're still broken. Mm-hmm. Like you're born broken. You're born with a messed up will, and God has to come to you and call upon you before you can come to him, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't come to him on your own. You're done for on your own. And then it wasn't until you have the 5th century with a guy named Pelagius. I know I'm throwing all these names at you. I just want you to see this development, how important it is to understand that theology develops. But you have a guy named Pelagius who comes, you know, on the Heretics Corner at the Prios,
mm-hmm.
He was the heretic of heretics. Actually, I feel sorry for Pelagius. I really do. I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. But anyway.
You feel sorry for a lot of heretics.
I do. I think heretics are, you know, they play their part. They
yeah,
really do.
Yeah.
To create the buoys out there so that nobody swims past them.
It's like Judas. You had to have him.
Yeah. That's so. But okay, so you have Pelagius comes in and says, he's mad at St. Augustine because St. Augustine says, in his Confessions, greatest line in church history, I think, Lord, command what you will, but will what you command. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's great stuff. Because Augustine was a hooligan, right? He mm-hmm. was a bad guy before he came to Christ. And he still struggled even afterwards. And so you have Augustine calling on the Lord in his sovereignty. He was like one of the first Calvinists. But he calls upon the Lord in his sovereignty. No, I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. I get in trouble for a lot of things. I'm like, he's not a Calvinist. That's anachronistic. But so he says, Lord, I cannot do what you want me to do unless you cause it to happen. That's what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
Command what you will, but will what you can, man. Bring it about. So Pelagius wrote to him and said, you're crazy. You have the same chance as Adam and everybody else, right? And that's where, in the 5th century, that's the first time it got articulated that the church believes that we are broken in and with Adam, at least to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
So development. All I'm trying to do is show you development. And the important things develop first, right? You don't have it until the 16th century that we're really dealing with the canon of Scripture. 16th century. I mean, you could say, like, if you were to say dispensationalism didn't come in until the 18th century, I'd say, well, your canon of Scripture didn't come in until the 16th century.
Mm-hmm.
It was in development, yes, just like everything else. But, yeah, that didn't come in as it is until the 16th century, because we were forced by the institutionalized church to change and make the difference.
It is odd. It's like, I am curious if you were to ask someone when the latest date for a doctrinal development that would be accepted by them, what date they would say. It is interesting.
But here's the deal, too, whenever you say that. That's good, because you don't want to accept things. I've said this many times. This is not true. This is not a truism. If it's new, it's not true. If it's true, it's not new, right?
Mm-hmm.
I do say that, too. And I that's a general proverbial principle, but it's not always the case, right?
Well, also, it's how you define new, right? Because you can say dispensationalism is a new movement, like you said earlier, but it's been in development,
it's
right?
It's development. Development is the key. I mean, even Roman Catholics believe in the development of doctrine. I mean, look at the Mary.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, that comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I'm not Mary as like an ever virgin. She
okay.
was understood at that very early on, even though that's hogwash. But her is being assumed into heaven, you know, and all of a sudden, 1850, saying, yeah, we pronounce that as dogma, I'm like, okay, where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you know, this guy, this ingenious guy in some ways, named, he wrote the book, Essays on the Development of Christian Doctrine. I can't remember his name, but he's really, really, he just got named a doctor in the Catholic Church because he came up with how to answer, how come we have changed so much?
Mm-hmm. Is it development of doctrine?
Yeah, it's the development of doctrine. That's what it's called. But we have a development of doctrine too. Everybody does.
Well, yeah, but we've had it forever. That was a like that was that's been understood, right? I mean, in the Protestant church.
No. Sometimes they don't think that. Sometimes Protestants do the same thing and say, "No, we can find exactly everything we believe the way we believe it in the earliest church." And I'm like, "No, you can't."
Mm-hmm.
What's the problem with saying it develops? What's the problem with saying a seed becomes a tree, a DNA, a baby in its mother's womb becomes an adult. It's still the same DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you're working with the same DNA, which we are, I mean, it's not like we're bringing something new in, or it's not like, you know, the Assumption of Mary or something.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a test of a doctrine. Is it something that comes out of the Bible and is a development, or is it something that comes completely out of nowhere? And it's something that's invented. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, listen, we got to talk about this more sometime, okay? We got to keep on talking about it. But how long have we gone?
I don't think very long. 15 minutes or something?
It's not 15 minutes. It is not 15 minutes.
I don't know. I've got time.
Jesus.
31.
I thought I never press record. I was just getting ready to tell you just to leave. Okay, good. 31. I thought it was like an hour.
No.
You're so boring to talk to.
I know. I don't have much. I told you I didn't have much to add. I just got questions.
I'm dominating. I don't mean to dominate.
I'm a biologist.
Obviously, I love it. Yeah, he's going to become a doctor, so he's going to support this ministry sometime soon.
I'll be a patron. Yeah, thank you, patrons.
Big patron. Man. Thank you, patrons. Okay, so you've got a lot of components that come in to say that the first critique is invalid whenever you start that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's based upon whether the validity of the principles that are involved are valid. Whenever you say something like it started at this time or here's some, here's one I hear all the time. It was invented by the Rothschilds so that Israel and propped up by Israel so that American evangelicalism would support Israel.
Mm-hmm. I hear that. I do hear that. I've
it's crazy.
That. Yeah.
It's crazy. And it's like, here's what I think. Whenever I see that at first, I'm like, whoever's in control of that's not doing a very good job. Because most people, Israel's not doing very well. They've never done very well.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're in control of all this stuff, you know, making stuff happen, they really stink at it. I mean, seriously, think about it. They're the most persecuted group in all of world history.
That's true.
And if it came about in the 1900s, then you have the Nazi. I mean, were they preparing? They said, we know Hitler's going to do this, so let's build a Bible study group named Dispensationalism based upon the principle of authorial and intent hermeneutics to see something brand new, which is not brand new at all.
I'm not sure if you've heard this, but when is the argument that people do argue that Israel and the Rothschilds...
I don't know.
Because they say that it's during World War One that it begins.
None of that would surprise me, because dispensationalism doesn't say Israel's a great group.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't even say you're supposed to love Israel in a way that is unique.
So what does it say?
It says number one that there's a future for them. Okay, that's first.
Which is that's
what Abraham heard.
Yeah, that's.
But let me explain this, because it's really important. Because I know they're probably saying something completely different. But dispensationalists, here's what we believe. We believe that the church is the new Israel, right? But we're not ethnic Israel. Ethnic Israel still has promises yet to be received. He made it to Abraham. That's what Abraham heard. It would be a major end around to say, yeah, I'm just going to spiritualize that. Now, I know you thought it was going to be your progeny.
Is there any like subtext for that found or any other the promises being this big end around thing? You know what I mean? Or is it just that specific one that people look at?
No, it's very specifically, like Paul says, not all of Israel is true Israel. Meaning, even within Israel itself, there's a true Israel. What does it mean? It means believing Israel is true Israel. They are the ones that are going to inherit the promise, believing Israel only, right? And then he says in Galatians that we are the new Israel, the church. And so that assumes us into this promise. Think of an olive tree, right? Because that's what he uses in Romans chapter 11. The rich root of an olive tree. An olive tree grows up. Israel is one of the branches, but they have become disobedient, Paul says. So what does God do? He cuts them off and grafts in a wild olive branch, which is the church, which is the Gentiles. And then that's growing. And he says, don't be conceited, because God is able to graft Israel back in. And in the future, that is what he's going to do. He is going to bring Israel back into the olive tree. So it's not as if we're saying basically this. Genesis chapter 3:15, right? Protoevangelion. God said, I'm starting something here. It's going to save everybody. Let's just call it right now, crushing the serpent's head.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they know. And then later on, God says to Abraham, I'm going to give you children, and this time I'm going to save the world. So your children will be blessed. And tells Isaac, his name is Israel, changes his name. Through those sons, the 12 tribes of Israel, this is what comes about, right? They carry the law. The Christ comes through the line of Judah. So what is that at that point? That's just the incarnation at the time of God's salvation. It's his blessing. I'm going to bless people. I've got my, the way that I might put it is, I've got my elect that I'm going to save throughout history. And at different times, it is called different things. But if I make a promise to you along the way at some point, I will fulfill that promise. I'm not going to change it around. It can be more than that promise, not less. So that is the key to say there is a future. This is key for ethnic Israel, believing ethnic Israel. That's number one. There's a future. Doesn't mean that I'm supposed to go, like I wrote today, doesn't mean we're supposed to go out there and raise red heifers, meaning try to get Israel's temple built and sacrificial system
built. Yeah, that's another thing I hear all the time. Yeah. We're supporting Israel to such a degree to bring about the end times effectively.
Now, this is very true. There is some truth to that. I'm not saying it's right and it's part of dispensationalism. I'm just saying you have people that are representatives of it that may get excited. It's like, if you think about it, you're like...
Well, I do hear them. I hear that grouped in with the dispensationalist view exclusively.
What?
You know, I don't hear those... The idea that we're supporting Israel to bring about the end times, I never hear those separated. You know, like that and dispensationalism, to me, just as a general thing, those are part of this exact same movement.
Jesus said to these Pharisees at one point, he says, how can you not recognize, you can recognize that rain's coming, but you can't recognize the signs of the times. And so there's this idea that whenever Christ comes about, there's going to be signs. We're not going to know the day or the hour, but there will be signs. And so whenever somebody believes that Israel still has a land to inherit, they don't have to inherit it right now before Christ comes. But if they start to inherit it now, it's kind of like Mark Hitchcock says, how does he put it? Okay, so whenever you start seeing Thanksgiving decorations at the stores, you know Christmas is close, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like that. He says, whenever you start to see Israel becoming a nation, you know it's close, right? So it's the signs of the times. It's what's preparing for it. It's not necessary, but it's what's preparing for it.
And the whole idea is that they have to fulfill a certain border, right? That's the idea of our
support. Oh, yeah, for sure, sure. Okay. And he lays out the border a few different times.
So I'm
very detailed, and I believe it's in Numbers, because I just read that last night in my Through the Bible in a Year reading, but... I think I just read that last night, details of the borders. But it doesn't have to be fulfilled until the millennium. So So not this age. Mm-hmm. None of this has to be fulfilled until the very end. You have to have a temple, and you have to have Israel sacrificing again, because you have to have the Antichrist come in and set himself up as God of the temple. So if you don't have that, here's what you've got. And then if I was sitting next to a, you know, somebody that was a all millennials covenant theology, I'd say, well, the first thing I want to know is what's your method of interpretation.
Is that meaning that you think we're in the millennia right now?
No.
Or that there is none?
Well, it could be that you're in the millennium right now. It could mean that there's just symbolic. It's either whenever you say you're all millennial, you're not saying there's no millennium. You're saying it's either typological or it is symbolic or it's historical. And historical just means it's cyclical. It happens all the time. Antichrist all the time. Bad things happen all the time.
Okay, so I hear Nero as a defense for that view a lot of the time. Like, I'll hear that Nero was an Antichrist. Yeah. Another one comes up later. And
I think that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I think there's always types of that which is to come. But you can't definitively say what those types are. It's just kind of... it's kind of like what comes around goes around, or what has been always will be, that type of stuff. So it's nothing changes. But at the same time, in the Bible, there's very specific things. I think the Antichrist is one of those things that you find both. You'll find literally in the future, because that's what Satan wants to do. He's got his big plan. If you're an all-millennialist, you have to have Satan in prison right now, not messing with the world. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
It's just, it doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Yeah.
But having said that, I would say to them, and there's so, so much to talk about with this stuff, right? I've just thrown this stuff out, being excited.
It's been 40 minutes already, and I don't think we've touched the present century. So.
Well, here's what I would say. I would say, what do you do with, say, Revelation chapter 13? You know, the beast coming up out of the sea and 666. I would say no specifically what he's... they must say they were symbolic. It's probably what they'd say. I'd say symbolic of what, though?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me exactly what. Now, they would say, well, I don't know. It could be this, could be that, could be this. I'd say, then, I guess this doesn't mean anything, really. Because if it's just symbolic and we don't know what the symbolism means, there's something wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
It's either got to be historical of some sort, or it's going to be historical and symbolic, but it can't just mean nothing. And you can't just say it's symbolic and then not have any definitive hermeneutic to mine out what that really means. What did it really mean to the original author? What can it mean beyond that? And whenever you talk to, and whenever you're talking to me as a dispensationalist, I have a hard time too, right?
Well, I am curious, because how would an author interpret that? I mean, obviously, I wouldn't say that that's a literal passage. That's all, you know, that's symbolism. What I would say. Yeah. But to an original author who's hearing that directly, how would they consider that anything other than literal?
Oh, they want it. They want it because it's called apocalyptic literature. In apocalyptic literature, it was kind of this grandiose speaking. There's going to be blood from the sky, and the blood's going to come up to the saddles, and... you know, it's that kind of talk that meant something more than what it did. It's illustrative, very illustrative. The moon is going to turn blood red. The stars are going to fall from the sky. It doesn't mean those things are actually going to happen. It means that this is going to be a terrible, terrible time. Whatever Christ says that...
And you think that would have been understood by the original authors?
Oh, yeah. Okay. For sure. At least to some degree. Not all of it. Like I said, it can mean more than what you understand, but not less. That's what I would say every time. Let me give you Isaiah chapter 7 as an illustration. Best one, okay?
What?
I don't have my Bible close to me. But okay, Isaiah chapter 7. You've heard it many times. It doesn't matter. You've heard it many times.
Okay.
Isaiah says you've heard it at Christmas. I keep on forgetting so much. I've probably been talking and just sitting there on you. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going back and forth. Okay, but Isaiah chapter 7, you've heard this many times, Christmas time. Behold, to us a child is born. A child will be given. And his name will be Emmanuel, you know, and before, well, I need to.
Where's your Bible? I'll go grab it.
There it is.
Pull it up in your phone. Where's my phone? I don't, oh, here's mine.
This will show you the this will show you how a scripture can have more than one meaning. It's called the sensus plenor, the fuller sense. So whenever we're looking at this, we find the seed, but it can grow into something more.
Mm-hmm.
So in Isaiah chapter 7, which is just a basic Christmas passage that everybody reads and everybody has memorized except for me right now. Where's, oh, do I have that? Okay. You wanted to look at you for a second here. There you go.
Yeah, just while you're looking. I don't know, should I? This is a pilot episode,
this,
everybody.
Why do you have this in alphabetical order? That's just dumb.
What in alphabetical order?
Oh, it's set up in, okay, never mind. It's just the whole Bible is in alphabetical order. Oh. Okay, Isaiah chapter 7. Okay, and the Lord said to Isaiah, go forth now and meet Ahaz, King Ahaz, right? Isaiah was always fighting with King Ahaz, and Ahaz was a bad guy, right? So he's going to him, and he's a prophet. And in Israel, you had the prophets. They go to speak kings, and kings are supposed to listen to him. And he says, okay, take heed and fear not. There's a guy... I forget what his name is, Shalmaneser, coming in, and he's from Assyria, and he's just getting ready to wipe out Israel, and Ahaz is scared. What's going on? And Ahaz, Isaiah is going to give him some comfort, because he got a word from the Lord, and said, the Lord basically said, Assyria is not going to take down Israel. Don't worry about it. Even though Ahaz was a bad guy, God's giving him comfort. And it says, the Lord again spoke to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign of the Lord your God. Ask from the depths or the heights above. But alas, Ahaz said, I will not either tempt or test the Lord your God. And he said to him, hear ye now, O house of David. Is it too small of a thing and weary? Okay, therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and he shall be called Emmanuel. Butter and honey he shall eat. And he may not, that he may not know to refuse the evil. This is King James Version. I haven't read this a long time. To refuse the evil and choose the good. But before the child shall refuse the evil and choose the good. This is basically before the child is old enough to know the difference between good and bad. The land that thou abhorrest, Assyria, shall be forsaken of both her kings. The Lord will bring this upon him. So basically, this is what's being said. This is God talking to King Ahaz in the year 700 BC, right? Bad problem going on, Ahaz. Whole army, Assyrians, the scariest army in the world. I mean, they knife staple people's tongue to the ground and leave them like that till they die. I mean, it's just horrible stuff they did. Assyrians were the ones who came up with crucifixion. But, so Ahaz is really scared, and Isaiah says, hey, listen, here's God, the Lord has given you a sign that everything's going to be okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
This virgin over here will be with child. And once she has a child, before the child is old enough to know good or bad, this enemy of yours shall be defeated. That doesn't make any sense, right?
Mm-mm.
How would that be anything good to Ahaz,
mm-hmm.
right?
Or even understandable at all?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For anybody there.
Yeah,
yeah.
What Ahaz is hearing whenever he gets that is, okay, but here's one thing. Here's a caveat. The word for virgin can also just mean young woman. So it doesn't have to mean virgin. There's much implication that it is virgin. So much so that the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew, went ahead and put it as the only word for virgin, but it doesn't have to mean virgin. It does mean virgin to Matthew later on, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the time of Ahaz, it wasn't a virgin. And Isaiah had to be giving him Ahaz a actual sign at that time. So basically, he says to him, look, see that woman over there? Or maybe a lot of people believe it was Isaiah's wife. He says, behold, this young woman over here, this is your sign. She will have a child, and before that child turns 5 years old, your enemy will be gone. So Ahaz, like, oh, okay, shoot, you know, we're going to be okay. But he doesn't say, hey, I'm going to give you a sign. Don't worry about it, because in the future, in 700 years, I'm going to have this virgin named Mary who's going to have a child. Mm-hmm. And before that child is old enough to know good or bad, your enemy shall be gone. That doesn't do Ahaz any good.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's called a far near reference, or a double meaning. It means something to Ahaz, means exactly what it means to Ahaz, and it gets fulfilled to Ahaz exactly, but it means much, much more. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good example of a double prophecy, of something that means something in the original context and cannot mean other than that, but it can mean more than that. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
This is really, really
deep. But it's like, it is a little scary whenever you're looking back, you know, trying to figure out everything that has been fulfilled, you know, whenever you're reverse engineering prophecies and stuff like that. Why you have to have it have a double meaning. Like, it had to mean something back then. Because if you're just looking for reverse engineering all the prophecies, you'll find something for everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, what you say right there, reverse engineering prophecy, is really funny because we call that which was not an actual predictive prophecy a typology of some sort. Some prophecies in the Old Testament are, say, very specifically, this is what's going to happen. This is how long it's going to be till it happens. There's no meaning right now. I've already established myself as a prophet. I don't need to give a far near. Because a lot of times a prophet, whenever he's acting on behalf of God, people would say, how do I know you're acting on behalf of God? Unless you give me a sign close, and then I'll believe your far sign. So it's a far near prophecy. And that's what happened many times. But sometimes there's just a far prophecy, like Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53 talks about, it's the greatest prophecy in all the Bible. It's, the most specific prophecy about Christ. Didn't mean anything in that day, but it didn't mean to mean anything in that day. But some of them just mean something in the past, and some of them mean some, or for the future, and some of them mean something now and in the future. So that's why I use the word sensus plenor. Is there a fuller sense to this? Can it grow and become something else? Is it supposed to grow and become something else? But whatever it becomes, we're not positive. We're just sure of what it is in the context.
Okay. So with that, let's go roundabout. Let's go back to Abraham's prophecy, or promise.
Okay.
Okay. You can read that if you'd like.
All right. I need to get to a different version.
Why not? I love King James. It's the only one I read.
Well, I can't read. I'm not used to it. It used to be that's all I read, too, growing up. Okay, let me see here. I'm going to read it. I'm going to try to find it in all four places. This one's easy. Now the Lord God said to Abraham, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, which he's already done. That's, you could say that's fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I will bless you. You could say he's done that as well. I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you. Make your name great. Been done. So that you will be a blessing. That's all been done, right? So this part of the prophecy, we could say, it doesn't need anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you go over to Genesis chapter 15. And you have the same thing repeated. You have God repeat it many different times in many different ways. Abraham's scared at this point. He's 90 years old, or over 90 years old. Sarah's 90. And he's like, this ain't going to happen. It's been too long. Because it's probably been 10 years since he got that prophecy in Genesis chapter 12. So 10 years later, he's like, hey, God, listen. I'd make a deal with you. Why don't you use Eleazar, my other son, from my wife's handmaiden that she gave to me to have a child, right? Because it was weird, I know.
Mm-hmm.
but can you use him instead? And God said, no, it's going to be somebody from you and Sarah. That's it. So think of that, what he heard, what he's hearing. He won't even go to his half his seed that was planned. Let's just take half the seed that was planted. Just use mine, don't you, Ceres, right? He says, no, no. It's going to be your blood. Behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of the household will be my heir. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. That man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him out and said, look toward the heaven, the number of the stars, if you are able to number them. And he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And that's when it says he believed the Lord and he counted to him his righteousness. Right after this, this is have we talked about this before, this passage?
Mm-mm.
Okay, listen to this. Next verse. And the Lord said, and he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of the land of Ur of Chaldeans to give you a land to possess. And he said, O Lord, how shall I know I'm going to possess it? I really like Abraham right there, because it's like, are you kidding? You're sitting here talking to God and you don't believe him.
It's just like all of us.
I know. It's kind of like, how can I know for sure? I know you said it, but can you give me some type of for sure? Maybe he thinks God's going to back out on the promise. You know, that may be it. And he says, how do I know that this is a promise that is going to stay? That's basically what he's saying, more than anything else. How do I know you're not going to back out? So what does the Lord do? The Lord said to him, bring me a heifer 3 years old, a female goat 3 years old, a ram 3 years old, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he brought them all to him, and he said, cut them in half, and he laid them on each half over against the other. So basically, they're all spread out, right? And the idea here was cutting a covenant. Cutting a covenant was to where you'd cut the animal in half, you'd put it in a kind of gully, and the blood would go down into this, kind of make a stream, you know? And each person would walk through that blood and say, so shall I be if I break this promise, right? And so they were both supposed to do this, because there's supposed to be some obligation on both parts, right? I'll do this if you do this. That's what a covenant is. But what happens? God makes him bring all these things to him. Abraham probably thought he was going to have to commit to something, but Abraham already believed him, and it said it counted to him as righteousness. And the sun was going down, a very deep sleep fell on Abraham. This is reminiscent of Genesis chapter 3 with Adam. A very deep sleep fell upon him. This is the Lord doing it on his own. He makes a deep sleep fall on him just like he made a deep sleep fall on Adam. And he said, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and be servants, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. So more of the understanding of what's going to happen to the Jewish nation. Now understand, this is his offspring. This is the only thing he's hearing at this point. He's not thinking spiritual offspring, right?
Mm-hmm.
It can mean spirit, and he's probably going to be happy, you know, later on. Man, it's your nation not only birthed this, they birthed the church, and everybody inherits the land together. And that's what he's hearing, his land.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I mean, that is pretty, I mean, that's, you can't take that any other way than literal.
His land. And one of the things you ask people that don't believe in the land, you say, well, how has the church inherited the land? They either say, number one, Israel gave up the covenant because it was conditional. No, it's not. This is a covenant cut by himself. God makes him fall asleep. Well, it's spiritual. No, it's not. Then tell me the land spiritually. Is it America? Is it the West? If you say it's future in the millennium, then you're right there with me. We're done, right? We just agreed.
So you would say, if the church were to have that actual land, is that what you're saying right now? If they were to occupy, if the church to occupy
the
land? No, but
you know that, the Crusaders thought that way. Remember, the Crusaders going to take Jerusalem. Why? Because they're the new Israel. And so they're fulfilling that promise. So there's always been kind of elements of that. Some people have even said America is the new Israel. But people like me, I say, no, Israel is Israel. It's that we've already mapped it out. There's plenty of places where it's mapped out. It's going to be that eventually. And he has to inherit it forever because that's what God told him. And now listen to this. When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking pot, fire pot, and a flaming torch passed between the pieces of animals. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham saying, in your offspring, I give this land from the river Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. the land of the Kenanites, the Kenizzites, the Cabanites, the Hittites, the Pezzerites. I mean, I never even noticed that. Raphaim, which is basically a descendant of the Nephilim. That's weird. I guess they had their own land. The Canaanites, the Amorites, the Jebusites, basically names it all. You can map that all out. I mean, good enough. You don't have to map it perfectly. You don't have to say, all right, how far does it go before you? You just know that there's this piece of land, and they haven't ever even occupied all of this yet. Even to this day, they never occupied it. So you would have to say, I mean, we can keep on going on the promises if you want. There's a lot.
No, I just think it was good for some context of how it all connects back.
I mean, here's what you got to say is, did they ever inherit this? And if they didn't, why? Then you say, well, because they forsook God. No, that's the promise. It's unconditional. God made it very clear it's unconditional. Okay, unconditional for what? Well, I think it's unconditional then for the church. Well, okay, what's the land? Well, it's spiritual. Oh, I don't... That's nothing what he would hear. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to... You're reading into that something that you cannot create a rule to find. And that's what I often say. If you can't create a rule to find it, then you cannot have it. You cannot just say it seems that way or hope... Maybe it's that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Authorial intent hermeneutics demands that we start with what the original author heard, what it meant to him, and then you move on from there. That's key.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. It makes sense. I do think it's good to equate it with other prophecies too, because it makes it make a. It's whenever it's isolated, it can seem a lot different.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and you start reading the Bible this way. It's not that you read it dispensationally, like there's different dispensations. But you read it from the standpoint of what did the author mean in the original context. And then at that point, dispensationalists would say, we're fine with that. I mean, even if you don't become a dispensationalist, that's the most important part.
Mm-hmm.
Because we cannot make the Bible mean what we want it to mean. And if you don't have the authorial intent hermeneutic, you can come up with anything. And the church has. We have for 2,000 years. Crazy stuff.
You texted me the authorial hermeneutics or whatever the other day, and I was incredibly confused, so I'm glad we went through this.
Did I?
Yeah.
Huh. I've been talking about it so much that I don't even know anymore. So, all right, we're going to keep on talking about it. And
okay.
Sorry this went so long. And
let's do like deuterocanonical books.
No, let's do dispensationalism more.
We can do that too.
There's a lot more we can do on this.
Okay, that's fine with me. I do want to go over deuterocanonical books and some apocrypha. I think that would be fun as well.
Yeah,
it's not boring. It's very fun.
You mean like Enoch?
Enoch's awesome. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
If you want to talk about giants?
Nephilim, and I got excited.
I can do Nephilim. I can do Dogman. I can do Bigfoot. I can't do Flat Earth. But
do you still have your little figurine back there
somewhere? Somewhere over there. Did you got that for me?
I can't remember. Probably Lindsay.
All right, guys, thank you so much for listening to us. tell us what you think about all this. If you liked it, let us know. And
we're going to keep doing it, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, we're going to keep doing it. the camera's not very good, but it's okay.
Yeah, and we're gonna get the camera's looking right next time. We'll have one pointing.
No, we're not. It's going to be the exact same.
Look, whenever we'll do it next time, we'll have it like this one facing you a little bit and that one facing me. That way they can see our faces looking at each other.
Yeah, that's true. Or maybe we can just back it up and get us both.
Because we're kind of just looking at the side profile.
I know. Look, guys, here's what I'm doing. I'm sitting here just randomly pressing back and forth, back and forth. And so I tried to, like whenever I talk to them, oh, they don't care. All right, we'll see you next time.
Theology